Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's been 17 years since the Bush administration made the fateful decision to extend the war on terror from Afghanistan to Iraq. All the justifications for extending this war have proven false. No ties to al-Qaeda, no weapons of mass destruction at a cost of 4,500 American lives, around 32,000 wounded, some grievously, and hundreds of thousands Iraqi dead, at a cost of nearly $2 trillion. And today, Iraq remains unstable with continuing sectarian violence. My guest today wanted to know the mechanics of how that decision was made. Robert Draper is a journalist and author of several books, including his 2007 book on the George W. Bush presidency, Dead Certain. He's a contributor to the New York Times Magazine and was formerly with Texas Monthly. His new book features conversations with intelligence analysts, defense and State Department officials, and many of the principals to examine how this decision was reached. The conclusion? Combination of post-9/11 fear, groupthink, and a set of decision-makers who had a fixed idea that Saddam Hussein must be toppled and that Iraq under him posed a major threat to the U.S. The name of the book is To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. Robert Draper is my guest today. Robert Draper, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yep, thank you for having me.
There has been so much written about the decision to go into Iraq after 9/11. What was it that you wanted to convey about this decision, a decision that in hindsight was somewhat of a disaster, but this decision to start a war in Iraq after 9/11, after the war in Afghanistan got going?
Right. I'd start by saying that even though I had written a book about the Bush presidency and spent a great deal of time with the president and all of his subordinates, that book came out in 2007, and the Iraq War was still unfolding, though spiraling into chaos at that particular moment. And I was, at that time, unable to unlock what I think are the central riddles, not only of the Iraq War, but also of the Bush presidency, which is why did he do it when he did it? How important was the intelligence? Did it guide him or did it not? And could anyone or anything have talked him out of it? I don't think any other book was really able to unlock those central riddles. And so I revisited it at a time in the first year of the Trump presidency when we had as a president of, you know, a reality TV show star with zero political experience. And my, you know, hunch was that we got to where we are with President Trump because there had been a rejection of sort of government experience and expertise that allowed someone with no such experience or expertise to vault to where he is. And I had benefit this time around with, in particular, interviews with former intelligence officials who had been inside the CIA and at the time I was doing my other book and just weren't able to talk. Now they were, and I was also availing myself of the, you know, distance that allowed, I think, a lot of the principals to look back on what had happened and to sort out, you know, truth from whatever defensive posture they'd been in before to kind of protect their legacy.
Well, to answer that question, did intelligence lead the Bush administration into Iraq? From what I read in the book, it seems like it was a decision very much like our present administration. It was a gut feeling that sort of morphed into intelligence that supported that gut feeling. Is that a fair assessment?
For the most part, yes. I think that there was some intelligence that the president paid attention to that he believed made a dire assessment of Saddam and his weapons capability and his designs on America. But by and large, you're correct, Rich, in saying that in a way that 9/11 has been said was a failure of the imagination. I think that the Iraq saga was a failure of overactive imaginations. I think that, you know, the president continually said, even after the CIA demonstrated fairly capably that there were no operational ties between al-Qaeda and Saddam, he continually said that Saddam would love nothing better than to hand over his weapons to fellow evildoers who are trying to attack America. Almost everything I've just said in that sentence is in fact, you know, false. Saddam didn't have any meaningful ties to al-Qaeda, didn't have weapons, and furthermore, and perhaps most saliently, did not have any ambition of attacking the American homeland. And that fact was conveyed to the Bush administration less than 2 weeks after 9/11, when Saddam's right-hand man, his deputy prime minister, Tariq Aziz, wrote a letter to convey to the State Department and then to the Trump White, or to the Bush White House, saying in effect, look, we should be allies here. You know, that's I know, you know, my boss has said some ugly things, you know, playing to his base basically, but you know, they've Islamic extremists have gone after us. They've tried to assassinate me, they've tried to assassinate Saddam. We should be natural allies in this. And even if one could say, well, you know, why in the world would anybody want to be an ally with Saddam Hussein? You know, decent point. Nonetheless, that presents a frame of mind altogether different from the argument that, Bush was promulgating, that Saddam wants to attack our homeland. Nothing whatsoever supported that contention.
And it's interesting. I read that part of the book, and I was really struck. I'd never heard that before. The rhetoric in the days after 9/11 from Saddam Hussein was, this was United States getting its comeuppance, but back channels, they're sending, hey, we want to work with you on this. We don't want any conflict. And yet, just a few days after 9/11, on September 15th, there was a meeting at Camp David with President Bush and his principals, where after a discussion of whether Iraq was involved in 9/11, the president said, we'll leave Iraq for later. Which you write to many people at that meeting thought that that idea was dead, but you wrote, in fact, it was far from dead. What happened?
No, what happened was that after Paul Wolfowitz had seemingly unsuccessfully made this argument at Camp David to a bunch of startled principals that hey, we should be going after Saddam right now, not al-Qaeda. After that happened, then in an afternoon break, President Bush was standing by a fireplace, and Wolfowitz sidled up to him along with Scooter Libby and began to argue his case again. And Bush was receptive, and Wolfowitz said, you know, what we should do is take out Saddam's oil fields in the south and basically hem him in so that he's just the mayor of Baghdad. And then from there, as we kind of starve the regime out, we could support an opposition or in some other way invade a weakened capital city. And Bush was very intrigued by that. And so he then said to Rumsfeld the next day, hey, you know, give me some creative plan relating to Iraq. And so in this way, Wolfowitz, who I resist the notion that that somebody else made Bush's decision for him. I mean, he was the one and only decider, appropriately, to send troops into combat. But it's certainly true that Wolfowitz succeeded in what would have appeared to be a change of subject instead of managing to kind of conflate Saddam with al-Qaeda and with terrorism at a time when one would think that the president would be exclusively focused on going after the people who did this to us in 9/11. That was Paul Wolfowitz's feat, managing to get it on the agenda early and then keep it on the agenda.
Now, remind folks who Paul Wolfowitz was. In the book, you said you believe it was overstated that he was the architect of the Iraq War. But as you read through the book, Wolfowitz was at least a kinetic force for moving against Iraq.
That's very well put, Rich. He was, you know, Wolfowitz was the Deputy Secretary of Defense. In the previous Bush administration, he had been the Undersecretary of Defense to Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney during the first Gulf War. And previous to that, Wolfowitz had been an ambassador to Indonesia. I bring that up because that was a transformative experience for Wolfowitz, who himself had a real idealistic streak to him. And he was very touched by his experience as ambassador to that country, to see a Muslim-majority country that nonetheless was religiously tolerant, that was accepting of alternative points of view. And he believed that that same kind of thing could happen in the Middle East, that everybody deserved democracy. And then among the things standing in the way of that occurring in the Middle East was this brutal dictator, Saddam Hussein, whose atrocities he had seen committed against the Shia from his perch as undersecretary. He vowed henceforth that he would do everything in his power to push for a movement that would see Saddam overthrown by some form of military force. And so, and throughout, after 9/11, the Deputy Secretary of Defense was very, very much focused on this, was continually making that argument. And I think this is what happened, Rich, that President Bush after a while, believed that he had no other options but to go to war. But the reason that he believed that was that no one was presenting any other options. And the loudest voices in the room were the people who had been waiting for the opportunity to dethrone Saddam and who managed to conflate the issue of terrorism with the issue of this Iraqi dictator.
You mentioned for George Tenet at the CIA, Wolfowitz was just this constant hammering of, I want information on this. I want information on this. That sort of was with questions in which the answer was implied.
Right. Well, I mean, what you're specifically referring to were meaningful ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda. And in particular, something that interested him was a bit of intel that, had it proved to be true, would truly have been an important one. This was, and your listeners may recall this, the assertion that several months before the 9/11 attacks, one of the main hijackers, Mohammed Atta, had gone to Prague and visited there with an Iraqi intelligence services official. And so the assumption then would be that these guys were, you know, the hijackers were asking for material support. Now, there were lots of problems with that intelligence. Some guy who had seen a photo of Mohammed Atta, you know, after 9/11 said, hey, I think I saw that guy several months ago. It was very, very random, and he said he was only somewhat, you know, certain that it was the case. There were trip manifests indicating that it would have been almost impossible for Atta to have been in Prague at that time. But there was also, like, this kind of crazed leap of logic. I mean, because after all, what did al-Qaeda need Saddam and Iraq for? I mean, they pulled off a hijacking with pilot training and box cutters. They didn't need to bring another country and risk letting this secret get out. So the notion that these two were tied up in 9/11 just had no evidence whatsoever to support it, and yet Wolfowitz kept banging on that, as did Scooter Libby. It stretched credulity to imagine that a secular dictator would have much in common with these Islamic extremists. Now, the rejoinder to that would be, well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But once again, that presupposed that Saddam was obsessed with the undoing of the United States. He was not. There was no evidence whatsoever. I mean, not a shred of evidence to suggest that. Saying nasty things about America on September the 12th proved what a jerk Saddam was, but did not prove that he was a threat.
Well, there was a lot of overestimation of Saddam's control of Iraq and his ability to control the regime. There was much made of the fact that Zarqawi, the al-Qaeda operative, was believed to be somewhere in Iraq. And you write, you know, Iraq was a big country. You know, there was not a massive control in the country, as we found out once we were in there. What do you make of that, the idea that we overestimated Saddam's actual control of the country and knowledge of what was happening in his country?
Well, I think this is, you know, I think we're often prone to hyperbolizing dictatorial regimes and assuming that eyes are literally everywhere and that everyone is being watched all the time. As one of the leading CIA analysts on Iraq had described to me, this business with Zarqawi being in Iraq seemed to be so meaningful that he had been hospitalized in Baghdad. And he said lots of people from Jordan, and Zarqawi was a Jordanian, go to Iraq because they have a superior health care system relative to other countries in the Middle East. So it was, in fact, entirely unsurprising that Zarqawi would be there for that purpose. But the analyst went on to say that all sorts of people are wandering around Iraq, and it's not as if that someone every 3 minutes is demanding, you know, their papers. Zarqawi ultimately ended up in the north, a part which you correctly say was not under Saddam's control. It was under the control of the Kurds. And he was there confederating with Ansar al-Islam, which was a group that at that time had no meaningful contacts whatsoever with al-Qaeda, much less with Saddam. So we tended to, like, put into this grab bag all of these people, all these nefarious actors, and again assume that they all happen to be in the region, they all happen to dislike the U.S., therefore we are led to the irresistible conclusion that they're all hanging out together, plotting our ruin. And in the particular case of Zarqawi, that just proved not to be true. In fact, when he first came to Iraq, he wasn't part of al-Qaeda. Now, a couple of years later, he swore fealty to al-Qaeda, but that was actually during the Iraq War, not in the lead-up to it. So there's just tons that's factually inaccurate with that particular narrative.
My guest today is Robert Draper, a journalist and contributor to the New York Times Magazine, a journalist and author. He wrote a previous book on George W. Bush's presidency titled Dead Certain. His latest book is titled To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. It's published by Penguin Press, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you detail all the principles. And what before we talk about some of the other principles, I have to say about Paul Wolfowitz, of all the principals, he's been the most open to reassessing what happened in the lead-up. You write of a scene in the book where there's sort of a definitive post-mortem of the decision to go into Iraq. He is there. He's there listening to the president.
Last year, I was there with him. And I mean, we didn't go at the same time, but I went to see the Army War College do this presentation of essentially deconstructing all the things that went wrong with Iraq. And then a couple of minutes into the presentation, in walks Wolfowitz, the only presence from the Bush White House. I mean, everyone else are people in the military or members of the press or various people who condemned the war. And so it was remarkable to see Wolfowitz there taking notes, not disrupting, not rolling his eyes, not saying, I object to this or that. It's clear that he himself was continuing to internalize what had taken place. The other thing I would say is that unlike a lot of other politicians and government officials, Wolfowitz would go to the Walter Reed Hospital for Military Veterans and not just do, say, a photo op, far from it. He would go there and spend a great deal of time with the veterans and was a continual presence. And then he would also go to the Arlington Cemetery and just sit quietly by himself. So this was, I mean, the tragic impact of the war was not only hardly lost on Wolfowitz, but he continued to sort of internalize it, which I think is a commendable thing, particularly given how deeply involved he was in it. I mean, this is not a person who's spending all of his time rationalizing the justifications for war and then refusing to hear any evidence to the contrary. Instead, there he is actually internalizing more and more.
Well, through the book, you detail the conflicts between Colin Powell's State Department and Donald Rumsfeld's Defense Department. We know that there's oftentimes sort of conflicting missions between these two large government entities, but this was very different. And it wasn't simply a personality conflict. It was just fundamental disagreement that extended all the way down to the deputies to this. It was really dysfunctional, and it was dysfunctional to the decision-making leading up to the Iraq War. Tell us a little bit about this conflict.
Sure. I mean, what we're describing here principally are two titanic egos, two men who had been around the block many, many times. Donald Rumsfeld, who had once been the Secretary of Defense in the Ford administration, had been Chief of Staff as well, had been out of government for over two decades. And then Colin Powell is also experienced and immensely popular man who had now become Secretary of State. They both, were quite certain and self-assured of their own positions, and they were at loggerheads from the very beginning, even before 9/11. But especially as the subject of Iraq began to dominate discussions, it's not that Rumsfeld took a pro-war position, but that Rumsfeld, in his own way, gleefully would attack anybody else's positions that happened to be counter to invading, and Powell was mainly that. It became really frustrating for Powell that over time he began to realize he did not have the relationship with or the pipeline to President Bush that, in fact, Rumsfeld did. The State Department, which early on had been of the belief that, oh, this is a cockamamie notion, going to war with Iraq, they've got nothing to do with 9/11 and with al-Qaeda, this will just die of its own stupidity, and in fact gained a lot of credence and a lot of locomotion. And it was only by the summer of 2002 that Powell began to realize, wow, we are losing this argument. And it's at that time that he got his exclusive time with President Bush in the White House residence on August the 5th, 2002, and said his famous, you break it, you own it thing, and laid out really is the only person in the administration to do so, the likely negative eventualities of invading a country. Rumsfeld, again, pretty much all the way to the end, never actually took a position on going to war, and it's this is one of these infuriating aspects of this very brilliant man, but also one with a talent for exasperating people by answering every question with an answer and not taking positions himself, but instead eviscerating other people's positions.
Yeah, but you have to admit, his two deputies, Douglas Fife and Wolfowitz, were absolutely pushing for war.
They were, and so, you know, I think they were influential in different ways. Wolfowitz, we've gone over as the guy who got it on the agenda and kept it on the agenda. Fife, I think, you know, there's been a lot written about Fife and all of his nefarious alternative intelligence stuff and all. I don't think that was terribly influential. What was influential with Fife was that the Undersecretary of Policy ultimately managed to be the guy in charge of post-war Iraq. And Fife, I think, thought that was a real crown jewel because it would allow him then to enable the rise of the Iraqi refugee Ahmad Chalabi and have Chalabi, in effect, be the new leader after Saddam. But he didn't give much thought, Fife did, to what the climate would be like post-invasion. And the view, I think, that so many of them, certainly Fife, embraced was that the Iraqis would coalesce joyously around a new democracy and forget all of their sectarian problems. And, of course, tragically, that proved not to be the case.
And any time officials or even military leaders would say, we're going to have a heavy military occupation in the post-war, that was pushed down. And the planning was, it would be comic, except for the tragic dimensions of it. There was very little planning for the post-war. They thought they would be greeted as liberators, and we would just waltz out, and Iraq would heal itself.
Sure, there were two or three factors at work there that created that very tragic eventuality, Rich. One of them was that Rumsfeld was, as this bureaucratic warrior, always believed he was smarter than everyone else and believed in that the hidebound Department of Defense, left to its own devices, would have this heavy footprint in Iraq. And he believed there was a way to transform the military and saw Iraq as the opportunity to do so, to come in with this lighter force. As a corollary to that, Rumsfeld also believed it wasn't the military's job to rehabilitate a country that it had invaded. He joined with a lot of other people who kind of mocked how in Kosovo and Bosnia during the Clinton administration, soldiers would, at least in their caricatured notion, be like, you know, escorting kids to school and things like that. They basically had the view of, we don't do windows. We invade countries, and then we leave it up to someone like the U.S.
Of course, that's what the military did after World War II in Japan and Germany.
Absolutely, yes. And it's those were also protracted occupations, but they were truly successful, you know, models for how to do this. And it was odd how they would sort of pick and choose, you know, which models made the most sense to them situationally. And, of course, the third aspect then is what I mentioned before, the belief that, well, we don't need an extended stay and we don't need a heavy presence because the Iraqis will be so thrilled to have us there. They'll basically say, wow, thanks for our democracy. We're going to do the whole thing ourselves. And that tragically proved not to be the case. Yeah. And you're right. It sounds almost comical as we're talking about it now, but the consequences were so tragic.
Yes, for all the military families and military men that lost their lives or suffered grievous injuries from this conflict. Well, let's talk about the one other area, and this gets into the CIA and the idea of weapons of mass destruction. As you write in the book, Saddam Hussein projected this idea, even though he was rapidly wrapping up his any sort of details from the weapons of mass destruction program. Since the war, the argument has been made politically and in justification that everyone believed there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What your book points out is we thought it was, but we weren't sure, and we had no assets really to check it out, really, except the UN inspectors, which weren't finding any in the lead up to the war. But it was like a slow buildup in which the CIA just sort of pushed this idea up because it was popular within power power circles.
Yeah, I mean, especially coming on the heels of this protracted argument that the CIA had been having with the Pentagon and the Office of the Vice President about whether there are any ties between Saddam and al-Qaeda. So this was an exhausting argument, and when finally they landed on a justification that everyone could agree on, that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, it posed kind of a relief. Now, at the same time, to be fair to the CIA, I mean, you detailed it very, very aptly, Rich. The evidence was very thin. The evidence was outdated. It was based on assumptions that would prove to be misguided assumptions. But the belief was that Saddam had weapons before. He's certainly behaving like a guy who has them now. He's been deceptive to the weapons inspector. So we're going to conclude that that he's got them. Even so, if you put a gun to anybody's head, or even not from the CIA, they would have said, well, we don't know he has weapons. We think he does, but we don't know it. And B, even if he did have weapons, that doesn't make him a threat to the American homeland. We don't think this guy's going to use them on us. But as the Bush administration began to push for a case for war, George Tenet, the director of the CIA, I think with the best of intentions, believing that if the CIA was left out of the discussions, then they'd be relying on the intelligence of Ahmad Chalabi or someone else, intelligence that was utterly fabricated, as a cause for war, and best to have the CIA at the table. But in being at the table, they became part of the sales apparatus. I mean, Bush literally turned to Tenet and his deputy John McLaughlin in late December of 2002 and said, "You guys haven't done a very good job, though, so far, of being able to sell the case for war, to sell the argument that Saddam has weapons to what will be a mass audience we want to sell it to. Can you do a better job?" And it was to that answer, or to that question, that Tenet faithfully answered, "Yeah, it's a slam dunk. We can do it." But he wasn't like saying it's a slam dunk that Saddam has weapons. He didn't think it was a slam dunk. It was Bush, paradoxically, who was positive at that point that Saddam had weapons. He just wanted to know if these guys could do a better Madison Avenue job of selling it to the public.
It sounds like the decision was made pretty early. How much of this is due to, as you write in the book, you know, that there was an assassination attempt made on the Bush family when they were in Kuwait? How much was it just the enmity of Bush and his family's relationship with Saddam Hussein as far as this enmity, and that he had to go in the ultimate decision?
Right. I think the best way to think of what took place in 1993 with this thwarted assassination attempt was that it constituted a kind of, it resided in the Bush family as a kind of muscle memory. This is what we know of Saddam. He's not only a bad dictator, he tried to kill members of our family. And so what that meant at minimum was that Bush, who, let's recall, was a two-term governor from Texas, whose only other experience in foreign policy was dealing with Mexico. So Iraq was the only other country he really did much thinking about, and what thinking he did weren't good thoughts. You know, this is a bad dude, and he wasn't inclined to give Saddam the benefit of the doubt. So after 9/11, when on September the 12th Saddam is saying ugly things about America, it's proof to him that this guy is really bad. And then when they start ramping up this case for weapons of mass destruction, Bush got it in his head that Saddam so hated us, because after all he had tried to kill his dad, a former president, that he would confederate with other people who hated us and maybe hand over his weapons. That whole scenario was fantastical. There was literally no intelligence to base that kind of hypothesis on, but the president repeated it over and over, and a lot of Americans bought it, which is why overwhelmingly, really, the Americans supported the invasion at the time.
Mm. Two tragic consequences that we're still dealing with today.
Yeah.
The name of the book is To Start a War. Robert Draper, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Journalist and author Robert Draper is a contributor to the New York Times Magazine and the author of the new book, To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. It's published by Penguin Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.